We're talking with Dave Politis about strange disappearances in national parks and national forests. As mentioned, he has 470 cases that he's been looking at. But if you think about it, there are thousands of other victims, loved ones, family members who are tortured by these cases, these tragedies. The loss of a loved one stays with you for years, tortures your soul. Obviously has ruined families. The fact that there's no final answer, no closure, is the kind of thing that stays with you. We'll get into that and other cases in east of the Rockies, Pennsylvania, New York, Georgia, and a lot more coming up. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. Mentioned a couple of minutes ago, and I think you sort of sidestepped it because we were in the middle of a discussion of a particular case, but about the effect on families. Obviously, you talked to Dennis Martin's father. He's still affected by it years later. You must see that a lot as you talk to family members, people who are tortured even years or decades later by these losses.
You know, as I was walking away from Mr. Martin's house, he had tears in his eyes. We had tears in our eyes. Honestly, I drove back with my partner and I told him that in 30 years of investigating cases, talking to people in the workplace, being a police officer, that was the hardest conversation I've ever had with anybody. And, you know, maybe before I was a dad, it wouldn't have been as difficult, but I felt this pain. And I could see how it had essentially probably ruined this poor man's life with his wife, because it wasn't that far from his house that this happened, you know, probably an hour's drive. He never moved. He lived in the same house and, in fact, unbelievably had the same phone number. And I'm sure that in the back of his mind, he was always hoping that Dennis was going to come back. And I think as a parent, you've got to always have hope or some type of closure. I mean, not knowing has to be one of the worst things for these people.
It must tear the families apart, too. The wife says, "Dad, you were watching the kid. It's your fault." It's your fault. Or the guilt that's involved with that must rip these families apart.
Oh, there's no doubt. When you do the investigation and you start looking at many of the facts of these cases, what struck me is that every one of these dads on every one of these cases where these kids were never found, I'm telling you, they gave it the heroic effort to hang in there and to keep going and never to give up and to try and to be out there beating the bush every day. I thought, well, maybe it wouldn't happen as frequently, but every case I ran into, I mean, these fathers that were there, they never gave up. They didn't want to go home. You could just feel it.
You know, in reading the books, Missing 411, it doesn't seem to be any sort of demographic consistency about the people who are taken. And I'm just wondering, is there anything, any obvious links? I mean, it sounds like there are, well, for example, Pennsylvania, you mentioned the cluster with a lot of kids who had vanished, but there weren't all kids who were vanished in that area, right? There were some adults as well. And I'm just wondering, in that context, are there any similarities? It's across the board in terms of age and race, sex, DNA? I don't know. Is there anything that ties them together?
Well, talk about race for a second. It's very, very rare when you see somebody disappear other than a Caucasian. There were a couple of black people. Up until just recently, I had never seen an Asian person that had disappeared and not been found. And there was a professor from Oregon that was hiking alone just recently, within the last couple of years, and he disappeared. He was never found, and it's probably going to fall right into the criteria that we've set down. We're looking at that real hard. But no, it's mostly Caucasian. But wealthy, poor, it doesn't matter. I mean, there's a case out of New York we'll talk about later where a boy disappeared, probably one of the wealthiest families in the U.S. So no. It does seem as though, and it might have been the times, that families, large families, seem to have kids that disappear more frequently than small families. And in talking amongst ourselves, we were starting to think that maybe that was an issue of the times in the 40s and the 50s, late 30s, especially for rural people, farmers, ranchers, and things. Having a large family was almost mandatory. and versus today in a city dweller, having 10, 11 kids isn't very normal.
Back to Pennsylvania. Kids mostly disappeared, but you have a case of Marjorie West. Tell me about that one.
And Marjorie is one of those cases I was just talking about that disappeared on the northern side of this wilderness designation in the northwestern part of Pennsylvania. She was with her family, and her dad was fishing in a small creek. Mom was sitting in a car. Girls were picking wildflowers. And she got out of sight just momentarily. And prior to that, her dad had said, hey, don't play by those big boulders because there's sometimes snakes there. And her sister thought that she walked over by this boulder. And it was one of those brief, and she's gone. And right around where Marjorie disappeared, there's another boy disappeared probably within 15 miles under equally strange circumstances and was never found. Absolutely a huge search for these people, and absolutely nothing. No clothing, no nothing. And Marjorie's case played headlines for a number of months, and it's just one of those perplexing things that a few seconds out of your sight, and these boulders come up many times when you're in the woods. Either evidence is found in or near them, or people are in amongst them, and something happens. And going back to Yosemite real quick, Yosemite's covered by miles and miles of huge granite and exposed granite. And a lot of times these people are disappearing in amongst areas where there isn't a lot of cover. There's a lot of boulders. It's an interesting dilemma to think about.
Let's talk about Douglas Legg. I know that was a case that really, really got under your skin.
So Douglas and Dennis have a lot of similarities in my mind. So Douglas Legg, he was from New York, and his uncle was a banker from New York and very wealthy man. His name was Crandall Melvin. This occurred in July of 71 in an area called Newcomb, New York. And it happened at Newcomb Lake, and his family owned a 13,000-acre estate that is essentially surrounded this lake in a beautiful area. And the family went there to vacation with other members of the extended family. And Douglas was with his uncle, and they were going to go on a small hike. And he came out, and he was dressed inappropriately. And his uncle told him, hey, you got to go back to the lodge and change. And the lodge was in sight. And some kids were in the lake, and they were yelling at Douglas, hey, come on, blah, blah, blah. And he was talking to them, and he walked off and around a small ridge where his uncle was waiting and headed towards the lodge. And make a long story short, he never made it back to the lodge, and he was never seen again. And this is in a long driveway up to this lodge. Nobody comes up here. It's very restricted, just family. Nobody's there 90% of the time. There's some swamps in the upper northern reaches of the property, and there's an area called the High Peaks area as you're going towards Lake Placid. Very rough, very rugged area. Dennis disappears, and the family pulls everything out that they can to find this boy. I mean, Douglas disappears. The family pulls everything out to find the boy. And they make a call to California for some special canines and special search and rescue teams, and they fly him in. And Douglas had been gone a couple days at this point, and it appears as though private planes were probably used to get these people out so quick. They put him on the ground, and the dogs start searching. And nobody can believe what the dogs are doing. They're walking north, but they're not walking a little north. They're going way north. They're headed straight into this High Peaks area, super rugged, difficult even for the trackers to keep going through this area. And they walk up to one of the highest peaks in that area, over the top, and they keep going through swamps, through boulder fields, through everything. Eventually, they get to the western side of the city of Lake Placid, but they're on the perimeter of the town in the hills or mountains surrounding it, and the dogs go all the way around the perimeter of the town and back down the other side, and that's where They walk up to this giant swamp, and the dogs sit down, and that's it. Everyone kind of stops. And the search and rescue people couldn't believe it, but they said, hey, they are 100% positive the dogs were on the scent. And it was an unbelievable, almost 30-mile perimeter that they walked, and they couldn't believe that they were still on it for a little 8-year-old boy. And there's no way that they thought that the boy could have survived going up and down these mountains, because they figured it had to have taken them a week or more to make this round, because that's what it was taking them every day. They didn't make this quickly. It was a hard, hard path. And it's one of those searches that was, everyone was dumbfounded. Well, at the time that the search teams were called out from California, this is one of the only other times I've ever heard this, Green Berets come out, Green Berets land. Green Berets set up their own camp, and they start searching on their own. Don't talk to anybody. And they're working through the wilderness on their own. So part of this that the listeners need to understand is that the Green Berets are different than National Guards people. National Guardsmen come from your community. They're local folks. Green Berets come from all over the nation, and they're trained differently. And they have a vast majority of them have secret clearances. So they're not going to say anything. They're not going to talk to anybody, and they're going to go about and do their job. So whatever their mission was, other than to find Dennis, who knows, because they didn't talk to anybody. And they weren't working with other searchers, just like in Dennis's case. They were working alone, through the forest, by themselves. And that just doesn't fit with what you think about search and rescue teams. And when I talked about this at the conference up in this year, people couldn't believe it. They've never heard of something like this, where groups weren't working together to find somebody. It's as though they were on their own private mission that no one understood.
You mentioned that the uncle, this banker, was very wealthy. Could it have been that he called in a favor, contacted somebody in the government? Hey, send in some Green Berets and see if they can find them?
Well, it's absolutely possible, but the reality of that is I don't think that a common citizen would know that the Green Berets were available to track down missing boys in the mountains. Every other time you'd hear about a disappearance, hey, the National Guard was called out by the governor, and the governor authorized them to help search. The idea that Green Beret is used to find a missing boy is really unusual. And in all the cases I researched, the Legg and Martin cases stand out because of this.
Was it in the same time frame as the Martin case?
Well, Martin was 69. Legg was 71.
Makes you wonder if it's the same Green Beret unit.
It certainly does. And if you look at the mountain range that flows up starting with Martin's in the Great Smoky Mountains, and you follow that line straight up to the northeast, it isn't unfathomable that line of continuation of force just continues right onto that area of the Adirondacks in the New York area.
I would invite any Green Berets or former Green Berets who are in our audience who might have some insight into this to call us later on when we open up the phone lines. Maybe we'll get lucky and somebody can tell us what the heck was going on there. Let's go to another state, Vermont. You had a cluster in Vermont. You think of Vermont as a nice, peaceful place where nothing bad ever happens to anybody, but you've got some pretty dramatic cases from that area.
And it's just not a cluster, per se. It's a cluster in time and space, and it's one of the tightest clusters I write about in the books. And it's in the far southwestern corner of the state in the city of Bennington. And not only is it unusual because of the dates and the times, but the cases themselves are very weird. It's between 1926 and 1950. Seven people vanished. And first one I'll talk about is Paula Weldon, and she was going to a college there in Bennington. Good student. Parents lived close by. She was doing a job in the dorm on a Sunday. Decided she was going to take a walk out to a place called Glastonbury Mountain. And she went out there, and people saw her on the hike up towards the top of the mountain. And they talked to her, and she asked how long it was going to take. She was by herself, and they lost sight of her. Well, people down at the bottom of the mountain later on, it wasn't too far later, heard screams. And the screams were coming from a lower portion of the mountain near a swamp area. Searchers went back into that area, and they smelled a foul odor near the area of the swamp that wasn't consistent with the swamp, and almost thought that it was a dead body smell, but they could never find it. To make a long story short, Paula was never found. But Glastonbury Mountain to the Native Americans has significance because there was a lot of evil things that happened in that area, and they didn't feel safe many times traveling through there. And we found that on a historical search. Yeah, going back to 1937, this is probably a story you will never hear anywhere else. August 16th, 1937, Alice Baker was 20 months old and staying in a mountain home just on the outskirts of Bennington. This is a very, very remote area. You drive probably 5 or 6 miles from downtown Bennington, you're in the middle of nowhere, and there's probably a home, you know, every 4 or 5 miles, except there were two cabins pretty close to each other, 100 yards apart. Mrs. Baker needed something at the adjoining cabin. She left Alice alone for maybe 10 minutes. She comes back to the cabin, and her 20-month-old daughter's gone. Huge search. They call in everybody they can. They look. 4 days later, they find her a mile and a half from the cabin inside of a bush. The sheriff at the time said he believed that the girl was kidnapped, but he couldn't figure out how, why, or who did it. And the mom from the very beginning said, there's no way my daughter could even get out of the cabin to do that. So who could have been watching the cabin while she left and had the opportunity to take the daughter? That's what was just baffling.
Well, I mean, why couldn't it just be some sicko who happened to be in the area or hiding for some reason, some crazy person?
Oh, and it possibly could be. But if you think about that, if you have that mentality about it, you better be pretty careful around these mountain people because most of them carry guns, and they'll shoot and ask questions later. And I heard that many times from people, especially around the Great Smoky Mountains. They said, hey, no, people don't come around here and do those kind of things because we won't call the police. We'll take care of it ourselves. And everybody knows that. And then the reality of it was is that if you were going to take a child, why would you take her half a mile and put her in a bush? It was just so odd. And it falls within this time frame. And this is another case. Paul Jepson, another 8-year-old boy, is with his mom. And the Jepsons own the rights to have their pigs scavenge an area of the city dump adjacent to the forest line. And every couple days, Mrs. Jepson would go out there and move the fence that the pigs were into in a different area of the dump. And their son, Paul, would sit in the truck while the mom did this. So the mom's moving the fence, comes back, Paul's gone. Well, they think maybe there was a small avalanche in the dump, but they figured that was wrong. And then they figured that the son might have walked up into the mountains, but it was almost straight up into the mountains right next to the dump. They didn't think that could happen. Paul Jepson was never found. And there's other cases equally strange in Vermont involving people who die and are found in areas that don't make any sense at all, and they all fall within this 1926 to 1950 time frame, and then it's like something happened, the book was shut, nothing more happens.
I know you said I'm sorry, go ahead.
So the question is, there were 7 people I wrote about that disappeared in that time frame. Well, so why in those 24 years would this all of a sudden stop? And then you start to look at the time frames of the disappearances there versus in Pennsylvania, it went from 1929 to 1957. Vermont, it goes from 1926 to 1950. And you start to think, what was happening in that time period that caused all this chaos and kids disappearing? And then why all of a sudden would it have stopped?
We'll continue with our conversation with Dave Politis, go into a couple of other areas, including the Deep South, Georgia, Arkansas, and then perhaps, with time allowing, into Michigan and a couple of other regions. Don't go away. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Chasing down a hoodoo, that line in the song, kind of brings up the 600-pound gorilla in the room that nobody's talking about, and that means Bigfoot. When you have witnesses, as in the Martin case, describing something that looked like a bear but walked like a man carrying what appeared to be a kidnapped victim, in these national forests and national parks known for Bigfoot sightings. The fact that Dave Politis, our guest, started down this path because of his interest in Bigfoot, the books he's written about Bigfoot. I guess we're not talking about it yet, but we certainly will. Is there a link to Bigfoot in these cases? You know, you hate to have people go out and start trying to shoot Bigfoot because they might be kidnapping people, but it's a topic we have to touch on, and we will. We'll continue our conversation with Dave Politis, author of Missing 411, right after this on Coast to Coast AM. David, several of our listeners with military backgrounds have written in and suggested that for Green Berets to be called in, it has to be a matter of national security. There would be no other circumstance that would allow them to be brought into something like this. What could the national security interest possibly be?
Well, isn't that a great question? I wish I really understood that. And I've had hundreds and hundreds of people ask what my opinion on this is. And honestly, I can say that I don't think there's a clear answer to it. It's such a perplexing dilemma of circumstances that I don't think one answer completely fits. I've had 10-page emails come from MUFON directors saying that I've solved the equation on alien abduction. I've had people in the cryptozoology world say, oh, Dave, you finally figured out one of the interesting dilemmas as to what's going on here. And the truth, the more I'm involved in this, the less clear everything becomes. There's a guy, many of you haven't heard of this person. His name was Ray Crow, and Ray lives up in Oregon. Great, great man, crypto researcher. And when I first started to look at the strangeness that goes on in America, Ray told me, Dave, the more you learn, the less you'll understand. And I could guarantee that what we're talking about tonight, the more I learn and the more I start to think I know, the less I truly understand. And it kind of goes back towards to what you learned at the ranch, George. There are no firm answers.
It's just a high strangeness quotient, you know? It almost looks like it's designed to perplex us.
Yes, exactly correct.
You, as I mentioned, you got started on this path because of your interest in Bigfoot. And I know you've probably developed sort of an affinity for Bigfoot. You don't want people going into the woods armed to the teeth, hunting Bigfoot and try to shoot them because they're kidnapping kids. But I think it's inescapable that at least in some of these cases, it looks like a Bigfoot connection or something similar to Bigfoot.
Well, I wrote about stories up in Michigan area where a girl disappears and a small girl. And she's taken, and her dad and other hunters look for days for her. And they finally find her. And as they come up on her, they see a big dark creature jump into the water and swim away. And she's standing on this log, and her dad comes up and goes, we were calling for you. Why didn't you yell back? And she says, oh, he wouldn't let me do anything. And he goes, who? And she said, big dog, wolf. And the dad says, big dog, wolf? And she says, yeah, it took my hat off my head and ate it. And this is a girl named Katie Flynn, a famous story out of Michigan. And if you didn't think much of the story, but you looked at the history of the area, you'll notice that there's a lot of sightings of a big dog that does harm to people, and it's kind of folklore in that area. But Katie's story kind of has that ring of truth about it, that a girl so young couldn't come up with such a complex story, coupled with what the witnesses saw, something really, really weird happened. And then I write about other stories in the East, and I'm talking multiple stories where predominantly it's girls, and there's one story out of Montana, the same thing, where they're in a camp setting or they're in a rural backyard, the child disappears, they're found days later. Where were you? Oh, I was sleeping with the bear. You were sleeping with the bear. Yeah, he took me, and he kept me warm at night. And in fact, sometimes they even fed me. Really? And again, you'd think, well, this story doesn't can't be true. But then you read two or three or maybe even four of these, and you start to think, well, maybe it's something that we don't quite understand. But then when you talk to bear experts, they say there's no way a bear is going to do that. There's just no way. They said they'll kill the kid, they'll eat the kid, they'll bite the kid, but they're not going to cuddle with the kid.
I know you spent a lot of time with Native Americans, with the Hoopa tribe and other tribes, researching Bigfoot legends and sightings. Have you asked the Hoopa or other tribes about these disappearances, and have they also been victimized?
You know, if you look back in the history of almost every tribe in North America, they talk about tribal members that have been taken at certain points. And one of the things that seems to be a consistent thread amongst them is something that'll be near and dear to your heart, and that's a skinwalker. And a skinwalker is something that can transform back and forth between human and animal, and it almost seems as though between good and bad. And they're adamant that these things are real and that they offer a significant threat, and they've existed over the course of history. And if you look back in history and you read books about it, there's some vestige of truth, it appears, to some of this, and at least the author who wrote it, in their minds. And then you talk about crypto creatures. There's books written where they talk about tribal members being taken by different type of crypto creatures from different parts of the U.S., and sometimes they're eaten, sometimes they're taken as a slave, sometimes they're taken for a sex toy, whatever. But these books weren't written with this being named as a suspect, or me even talking about any of these legends. I think it's important for people to understand that these stories are strange enough standing on their own without me imparting my belief system about what may have occurred. And in the hundreds of emails I've had, I've consistently told people that I think my opinion on this probably unimportant. It's more important to understand the historical significance that this has been going on for over 100 years. And there's a consistent element here to that 100-year history. And for some reason, the powers to be aren't willing to admit it's going on, aren't willing to admit that they understand it's going on, and that there's got to be some type of cover-up on this at the federal level, because there's no reason in the rational world why the Park Service wouldn't be tracking people who disappear inside their system.
I know you pointedly in the books don't talk about what it might be. There are, you know, implications there, implied answers, but you really avoid that, and it makes sense, because the first step in exploring this is to establish that it's real, that people really are disappearing, that it is unusual circumstances, that there's no ready explanation, and that there is some sort of a cover-up. That should be step one.
And if you think about what we may have here in North America, including Canada, because there's a section in the book about Canadian disappearances, these issues don't stop at the border. But if you think about, we'll always think, okay, so we had grizzly bears in parts of British Columbia and maybe far northern portions of the U.S. We have black bears and brown bears in the rest of the U.S. And some mountain lions and things that could be taking the people. Okay, that's here in North America. But then what's going on in Malaysia? What's going on in Australia? Because they don't have those things. There's no grizzly bears in Australia. There's no big black bears taking people in Australia and Malaysia. So how could this be going on in other countries, almost an identical mimic to what's happening here? And then you have to keep an open mind on this. And in all the research I've ever done involving anything, if you enter it with a hypothesis, you're going to miss what's obvious. And people have always told me, Dave, you know, your opinion is important, but it's not important for others to hear it. And you're better off allowing people to develop their own thoughts and their own hypothesis once they've read the literature. And I think it's important. I'm not trying to sell the book at this point. I'm trying to tell you that once you read the same sorts of stories over and over again, and fish and game people say, No, it's not a bear. No, it's not a mountain lion. And yeah, this was the strangest case I've seen in 33 years because I can't tell you what did do it. And biologists come in and they say the same thing. Again, not opinion. These are all just facts.
Well, I think it's a lesson well learned. We've learned it from the UFO field. If you go into it with a hypothesis, you find evidence to support your hypothesis, and you really might miss something else. And it's wasted a lot of time in the UFO field and probably true for other sort of paranormal fields. So it makes a lot of sense to keep an open mind and not try to prove a point that's already predetermined.
And unfortunately, you'll have an appreciation with this because you're an investigative journalist. Once you start leveraging the crypto world versus the missing people, pretty soon that's the only thing everyone out there hears.
Right.
Oh, Dave thinks it's this. Oh, he's a whack job. Oh, this, oh, that. And then pretty soon people don't want to talk to you.
Yeah, they'll dismiss it.
That's it. And then the other missing people say, oh, yeah, I heard about you. You believe it's this. And we don't want to be involved in that. Hey, the reality of it is I don't have any idea what's causing this. There are some parallels with other things, but I'm not so much to be closed-minded to say there's something very strange here.
What cases jump out at you from the Deep South? I want to make sure we touch on that region. There's one, at least, that you've got from Georgia, right?
Yeah, and this is one of the few black people that I ever write about. His name was Chris Tompkins, and he was on a survey crew. And he was, again, the last person in line of a crew on a rural road, and he was standing on the shoulder of the road, probably within 10 feet of a barbed wire fence. And as they're walking along, you got to understand there's no curves in the road. There's no nothing. They're walking on a long straight road back to the truck. It's, say, 200 yards away. Everybody's tired. Everybody gets back to the truck. They look back. Chris isn't there. They walk back. And what they find is a series of coins on the ground right next to the fence, one of his boots laying on the ground next to the fence, and small pieces of his blue pants that he was wearing on the fence. So everybody, put your investigator hat on for a minute. You got one boot on the side of the fence. You got materials from his pocket laying on the ground. How does this happen? With my own investigative experience, I know that when I worked fatal traffic accidents, if a citizen is in a crosswalk and they get hit by a fast-moving car, sometimes they get knocked right out of their tight shoes that they're wearing on their feet. It doesn't seem possible, but it happens. And it's something about the human body going limp and the movement being so quick that they come out of it. Now, I'm not saying that this happened with Chris that quickly, but the indicators of things in his pocket being on the ground, meaning he was turned sideways at the very least, if not upside down, before he went over that fence. So he disappears. It's obvious he went over the fence. What's on the other side of the fence? Inhospitable country. Woods, snakes, swamps, almost impassable ground. So they do a search. They find nothing. 6 months later, the rancher that owns the ground on the other side of the fence, 800-900 yards on the other side of the fence, they find his boot, and that's it, laying next to a swamp by itself. Chris has never been found. And the owner of the survey company was upset. He's a friend of Chris's mom's. It was a big deal in the South, and there was a lot of allegations back and forth. And if I was the parent, not knowing what I know now, I might have some allegations that these guys did something bad to my son. Knowing what I know now about shoes coming off, about people disappearing near swamps, etc., it fits what we know about odd disappearances near woods and things of that nature. Why in the heck would his other boot be so deep into this abandoned, horrible area unless something very, very strange happened?
We got about 4 minutes before our next break. Nathan, my pal there at Premier, has a question about Louisiana. I mean, I mentioned that we played that song from Creedence about chasing down a hoodoo in the bayous, and I would imagine that's some pretty spooky and remote areas of swampy areas, Louisiana, and down that area. Any cases jump out at you from there?
And you know what? I guarantee you, there are a lot of spooky, strange areas with noises that you hear at night that are just scare the heck out of you. But unbelievably, there are none.
I know. Not
it doesn't
a one.
Make any sense. Does,
wow.
No, it doesn't make any sense to me either. We looked hard. None.
What about Florida, though, the Glades?
Florida has more cases than I could spend the next 10 episodes of Coast to Coast talking about. And we specifically excluded it because of that. You could almost write a book just about Florida and Texas. There are so many strange, odd disappearances down there. Now, we've started to look at the cream of the crop coming out of Florida, and so people sent us some cases that are just completely baffling. But you may hear from me in the future about Florida specifically, because there are some really, really odd things that go on there that would defy common sense, as we've spoken about tonight. But nothing out of Louisiana. Sorry.
Okay. Nathan, we tried. I want to take this moment to talk about the book. The last time you were here, you were just gearing up, and I know a lot of listeners were trying to buy it and couldn't. What kind of what can they do to get it now?
So if you go to the Can-Am, the work we do is under the Can-Am Project, and that's C-A-N as in Nancy, A-M, like Canadian American, canammissing.com. And if you go to the Can-Am site, you'll see Missing 411. And on this site, we have a series of updated articles about people who have disappeared. There's some reports in there from the National Park Service about people who have disappeared that we didn't write about but are equally as perplexing. And we kind of keep an updated log on some of the searches and things that we're looking at in North America that are directly applicable to what we're talking about here tonight. CanAmMissing.com.
And they're not going to have any trouble getting the book. You have plenty on hand.
Absolutely. No, I learned my lesson last time I was on your show, Georgie.
It's not for sale on Amazon, though.
No, it's never been for sale on Amazon, even though it appears. We've got a lot of great reviews on there. It's never been for sale there.
So two volumes. The first one, Missing 411, western part of the country. The second volume, eastern part, and that's what we're discussing tonight.
Western U.S. includes Canada. The eastern U.S. includes the eastern U.S. and farmers and sheep herders and berry pickers that have disappeared.
You know, what occurs to me as we have this discussion, something I didn't raise the last time is, you know, you said this goes back at least 100 years. It might be, of course, a lot longer than that. You look at folklore, fairies, little people, snatching kids all over the world. Those kind of stories are in every culture on every continent throughout human history, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, you know, the written record that we can get at right now ourselves goes back maybe 150 years. Sometimes you get some articles from the real early 1800s. And we can go back 150 years, and I've written about disappearances in 1848, 1850 that mimic what we're talking about here today. It's just hard sometimes to get a number of cases to show a consistency, because at that time, there really wasn't a good spread of newspapers across the U.S., predominantly on the East Coast, but it hadn't gotten out west that thoroughly yet.
Well, you mentioned Skinwalker, which is a shapeshifter, of course. You have many different possibilities. Maybe this thing assumes different guises, different shapes and forms, and changes through history. We can get into that as we open up the phone lines with your questions for my guest, David Politis, author of Missing 411. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us, everyone.